to Eye on Horror, the official podcast of iHorror.com. This is episode 122, otherwise known as season 7, episode 3. I am your host, James J. Edwards, and with me, as always, is your other host, Jacob Davison. How you doing, Jacob?
Doing fine. Just, Sunday morning and ready to do another episode with you guys.
You feeling better from your not COVID flu?
Yeah, there's more than one disease. And I'm feeling much better. The flu really kicked my ass. I got tested multiple times. It wasn't COVID. And although I am glad I was vaccinated for the flu, because even with it, like, it just kicked my ass.
I feel like you had a harder time with the flu than I did with COVID. Because my COVID just felt like a bad cold, but your flu, I mean, you look and sound better. So I can tell that it really kicked your ass back then.
Yeah, no, I had a fever and I feel like it was elevating my hair, because like I looked like a racer head every day while I was sick.
Also with us, as always, is your other host, John Correa. How you doing, Correa?
Oh, I'm so tired. I'm so exhausted, boys. I mean, I'm in Colorado right now, so I'm an hour ahead of you guys. So I got to supposedly sleep in a little bit, but I didn't. But like, yeah, the last week has been, or the last couple of weeks has been incredible and tiring. And I can't wait to share any news that might come out of it. But for now, just know your boy is working his ass off and is very tired.
you're setting me up for my dad joke of you're in the future.
You want the lotto? You want the lotto numbers?
But have you seen Sasquatch there?
I didn't see a Sam Squanch, but I did see trolls. Because if you guys didn't know, there's this artist who made these giant wooden trolls and all these different parts. It was like a big project. It was Thomas Dambo. Look it up. They're pretty freaking incredible. And one of them is out here in Breckenridge, Colorado. And they're so cool because they're just like gentle giants. Like, he's just chilling there. He's got his arm around a tree. This thing is like twice my height. I sent the boys some pictures here. I might post when we post the episode. But yeah, no, just, you know, taking pictures with trolls. Have we done a trolls episode? I want to talk more about trolls.
Yeah, we got to find the right opportunity to do all trolls episode.
And don't forget, they are making a troll 2 for that awesome kaiju movie that came out about a year or so ago.
I just said, they made a troll 2. It's the best worst movie ever.
No, that's trolls 2. Or wait, yeah, that is troll 2. And then Jay's got his favorite trilogy of all time there. But yeah, dude, just sleeping a lot, hang out with trolls. I got a book about Rasputin that I'm looking forward to read, you know, just living the best life, I guess. What have you guys been watching?
There hasn't been a whole lot of horror that's come out since last we talked, but I have been binging through The Leftovers. Have either of you guys watched The Leftovers?
No.
No, it was residual annoyance with the hype around Lost. So when Leftovers came off, I was like, I'm all set.
That's the thing. It's Damien Lindelof, or however you say his name.
Damien Lindelof,
yeah, who had his hand in Lost. And let me tell you, The Leftovers definitely sticks the landing a lot better than Lost. A lot better, which isn't saying much, because Lost didn't stick it. Lost, what I think happened with Lost is they expected it to only be like a one season thing, and it kept getting renewed. So the writers just kind of kept writing themselves into corners, and they didn't know how to end it by the end. Obviously they didn't, because the end was a total cop out. But The Leftovers, it got put on my radar because I saw one of those clickbait articles about the most evil characters in television history. And one of them was Liv Tyler's character on The Leftovers. And I'll say right now, I think maybe I was expecting more, but she's not that evil in The Leftovers. But it did get me interested in the show enough to watch. There's only 3 seasons, and they're actually pretty short seasons. I think they're like 8 to 10 episodes each. So you're not, you know, it's not a huge time commitment. But it's kind of like the blip in Marvel, where like 2% of the population one day just disappears. And it's dealing with the people who are left. And some people lost, like one woman in it lost both of her kids and her husband in the blip, while other people didn't lose anyone, but they still have to deal with, you know, the rest of the world having dealt. And there's one guy, he's a preacher. And when the thing happened, his wife was driving a car, and a car that the driver got blipped away, crashed into her. So she ended up in a coma for, you know, it's just everybody dealing in different ways. And you'll be interested, Korea. There are two different cults in it.
Oh,
one of them is a bunch of people who dress in white and smoke all the time. They chain smoke. And there's some sign that says, you know, we smoke to show our faith. So there's all these people who just are chain smoking. Anne Dowd is actually kind of the leader of this cult. And she's more evil than Liv Tyler in this. But they want to force people to remember that, or not force people to remember that they want people to get over this blip is what these people are doing.
Right.
And then there's another cult who follows this, this guy who claims to be able to remove people's pain by hugging them. And he actually fathers like a bunch of illegitimate kids. It's kind of crazy.
So it's more than hugging.
Well, with some of his concubines. Yeah. But people pay him to hug away their pain, so to speak. And the first season takes place in this town in New York. And then the second season, they go to this town in Texas that nobody got blipped away, or they call it departures. So nobody departed from this town. So everybody thinks they're safe in this town in case this happens again. So it's a big thing that all these people, they're camping out outside of this town because they all want to get into this town. And the third season kind of is all over the place, but it's pretty well done. I know that when we weren't recording off recording, we were talking with Ian Hunt Duffy last episode about The Leftovers. And, you know, his exact words were, I've been banging the drum for The Leftovers for years, you know, because it is a few years ago.
Yeah.
But I just got into it, and it's definitely worth checking out.
I mean, I've always been really excited at the idea of the rapture, you know, in Catholic, you know, doomsday thinking, you know, when all the good people get raptured and go up, what happens to those who are left? And, you know, that's always fun. And it's kind of like what James Gunn was doing with the Dawn of the Dead remake, because his idea was that, well, the people that would get taken out first in a zombie apocalypse are those helping each other. So you're going to be left over with the worst of the worst. And that's kind of like what a rapture is, right? All the good people get taken out. So I like the idea of the rapture as like storytelling, but until The Leftovers, the only one like kind of media we get of that is the Left Behind series with Kirk Cameron.
Oh, and then
there was
Nicolas Cage in that other one.
I was about to say that Nick Cage was in the reboot one, and now they have fucking Hercules in like another one. And like those movies are terrible. Hercules. Those movies are so bad. So I like the idea of like a non-preachy, and like, you know, I do need to get off or get over, I should say, of my disinterest in Lost, because David Lindelof has made some like really good, his Watchmen series was so good. So like, yes, I should give Leftovers a chance. Maybe that'll be my in-between Voyager and Enterprise series.
The Leftovers, the name doesn't do it any favors, because like you said, the Left Behind series, it kind of does sound like that. But yeah, it definitely is better than, well, it's more satisfying than Lost, because it feels like they actually had a three season arc planned out, rather than Lost, where I think it just got away from them. But one thing that Ian had said to us when we were talking is, he said, pay attention to the opening credits in, he says season two and season three. And season three is what I think he meant, because every, the opening credit sequence is always the same, but they play a different song. And the song has to do with that episode. Like one episode they play over the opening credits, they play the Perfect Strangers theme song, which believe it or not, actually does have to do with the episode. but the other, you know, they play, you know, a different song each time, and it'll kind of clue you into what's going to go on that episode. It's really well done.
What was the vibe of the episode that started with Mambo Number 5?
Is that legit?
I don't know. I haven't seen it.
It isn't. It is not legit, though. He's just...
That would have been great, though. I've been extremely busy these last few weeks. So I haven't been able to go out and see anything or watch anything at home or anything with my travels and everything. But I did... with Hooptober, there's always, I always have leftover titles, probably because I overstack it. I'd put more than 31 titles. So I created a list on Letterboxd on movies that I said I was going to watch during Hooptober, but didn't get to. And one of them was a bonus title from Hooptober called 10 Rillington Place. Have you guys heard of this one?
I've heard it. I haven't watched it. I have the Twilight Time release of it because it was when Twilight Time was, quote, shutting down. They had that big sale, and that was one of the things I got. But I haven't. It's a serial killer movie, right?
Oh, dude, it is more than that. Okay. It is. It is incredible. It's from 1971, and it was directed by Richard Fletcher, who did Conan the Destroyer, Red Sonja. I'm not hyping him up with those titles. Amityville 3D, Dr. Dolittle. But he also did the incredible Soylent Green and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Fantastic Voyage, Tora. Like, this guy has, like, he is a renaissance man. Like, he's done it. He's done, like, everything. But 10 Rillington Place is incredible. First of all, you have Richard Attenborough, right, playing a serial killer. Like, the movie opens up with him murdering a woman. It's fucking intense. In his building, and this is post-World War II England, and John Hurt's character, the very young John Hurt, moves into the building with his wife, and they have a child, like a very young baby, and it just kind of starts off into this, like, weird manipulation, because John Hurt's character is very uneducated. They show multiple times that he can't read, but he's trying to work and provide for his family, and at one point, his wife gets pregnant, and she's realistic and is like, we can't afford another baby and all this. And so that's when, like, Richard Attenborough's character, John Christie, you know, being on the bottom floor, his ears kind of perk up and he's like, you know, I did some medical stuff during the war. And it's just
based on a real, is this like based on a real case? This sounds super familiar. Like, I heard about it on Sword and Scale or one of my true crime podcasts.
It's one of those, I haven't looked into whether or not it's real, but it is one of those movies. It opens up and says, like, this is based on a true story. And okay, like, a lot of it is based off of, like, court documents, because it just goes on.
Sounds super familiar.
Dude, it's nuts. And, like, I'm not spoiling a whole lot going into the fact that, like, you know, Richard Attenborough ends up murdering John Hurt's wife, making it look like kind of a botched abortion, and basically manipulates the shit out of John Hurt into setting him up to look like he was the one that murdered her. And they go through the whole trial where he's sitting there, John Hurt, you know, his character, who's, again, not bright, is sitting there like, no, the truth will prevail. The truth will prevail. And you see the court happen, and it's just keeps going. And you see him slowly getting more and more destroyed emotionally, of just like, oh my God, they're going to fucking hang me for something I didn't do. And then, like, him trying to, like, rectify. And then it goes past that for years, and it's, 10 Rillington Place is honestly so incredible. It's tense. It's dirty. It's monstrous. Like, again, this is Richard Attenborough. I grew up with him as the dinosaur guy, you know, from the Jurassic Park series. This dude, like, narrates nature docs and stuff. And then all this, he played Santa Claus, come on a Miracle on 34th Street. And here he is just playing just the creepiest little bastard. And it's, yeah, I can't recommend it enough. I believe it's on Amazon Prime. I think I got it through a Fanflix deal digitally one time. And yeah, if anyone wants to sell their Twilight Time copy of it, I'm interested, because that was some real good shit right there. Highly recommend it. 10 Rillington Place.
As for me, well, I've been watching a lot of shot on video stuff, specifically from the Vinegar Syndrome sub-label Saturn's Core. Mm. Like, I saw two pretty out there movies from them. This one called Age of Demons, which I can best describe as if a bunch of punks watching Power Rangers and Kung Fu movies decided to make their own. Because, yeah, it's like a Kung Fu. It's like a heavy metal band that fights witches and demons and half a giant robot. And this other one that was pretty fun and, again, pretty out there, was called The Zombie Army, which was one of the rare shot on video regional horror movies that was written and directed by a woman named Betty Stapleford. And it's basically kind of a post Gulf War satire where it's like the army is reopening a base and they accidentally unleash a bunch of zombies, and the zombies turn the soldiers into zombies. So they send an all women platoon to fight the zombies. And it's all set at like this military base in, I think, Maryland. So it's always interesting digging into the shot on video stuff, especially the regional stuff, because, you know, it's very bare bones, like minimal to no budget. But a lot of these filmmakers, particularly from the late 80s through the early to mid 90s, had a lot of high concepts and a lot of effort to trying to make their weird ass dreams a reality.
I always have a bit of a hard time giving shot on video and to a lesser extent regional pictures a chance. I guess I'm a little biased, but I always love hearing the stories behind them and how they're made and stuff. Like, do you ever see Night Chills?
Haven't seen that one.
The D&D inspired.
Oh, wait, yes, slasher. I did see that. I did watch that. I got that Blu-ray from Vinegar Syndrome.
Yeah, because that one's really a lot of fun. That one was directed by Catherine Hicks. And when you said female directed regional horror, I was like, oh, dude, got to talk about Night Chills. That movie's fun, where it's like D&D players being stalked by night.
Yeah, quick aside. Yeah, just I love the concept for Night Chills because it's like kind of a flip on the, satanic D&D plot where it's like one of the players is bullied by the other players and they die in a car accident and their character, Night, comes to life and starts killing off the other players from the Dungeons and Dragons game one by one.
Yeah. I've never seen so much bullying in a D&D game before. That being said, when I played D&D, I was the bully in the group. So like, I guess that makes sense perspective wise.
Well, it's a good thing their character didn't come to life and kill you then.
Oh man, that would have been tragic.
Yeah, no, but yeah, no, I've really gone into shot on video and regional horror through sub labels, like from Vinegar Syndrome, and you know, between that and like American Genre Film Archive, Bleeding Skull, Saturn's Core. I usually blind buy just because I like being surprised, and a lot of these titles are just so out there, you never know what you're going to get.
It really is kind of like the mentality of just like, well, we don't have much in budget and stuff, so let's go for the most batshit thing we can possibly put on video as our selling point. And when you don't have money, go for shock.
And it's also funny because I feel like a lot of these titles also are kind of vehicles for bands that either were the filmmakers or were tied to the filmmakers, because like in Age of Demons, there's heavy metal band who also helped make the movie, and with Zombie Army there is some music from a band that was involved in the making of the movie. So like a lot of these I feel like were a lot of times vehicles to try and sell a band or their music.
Understandable. We'll never forget what I always forget what the name of it was, but there was like, it was a rap label doing a parody of the Blair Witch Project, and it was just different rap artists talking about this like curse of this like Blair Witch type figure. And you never see.
Wasn't it the Bear Wench Project?
Yeah, it was like that. And like Eminem pops up in it for like 2 seconds to talk about it. And they like never do anything. It's just literally just them talking about this like figure and stuff. And it was just so bad, but so entertaining. So yeah, long live regional uplifting independent artists.
Exactly.
Another thing that I watched, it's kind of timely with what's been going on, first with Batgirl and then now with Coyote versus Acme. But I saw Doomed, the untold story of Roger Corman's The Fantastic Four. Have either of you guys seen this?
Bunch of times.
Yeah, actually, a friend of mine worked on that.
Oh,
Jared
nice.
Skolnick.
It is. It basically is the original tax shelter movie. I think that in order to keep the rights for the Fantastic Four, they had to have a movie in production, not released, in production. So, and it's legendary, Roger Corman, and it has since been leaked. You can get bootlegs of it, and it's not a good movie, but it's a Roger Corman movie.
I will fight you on that. I love the original Fantastic Four movie.
A lot of Roger Corman's stuff was it's a Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie is what it is. And what sucks about it is when they're interviewing all the people who put their heart and soul into this movie, they really did work on it. No one knew that it was just a tax shelter movie. It wasn't going to be released. So these people, you know, poured into it, you know, and they promoted it, and it just never came out. Even Stan Lee at one point where it might have been at Comic-Con, he was talking about it, you know, and he basically disowned it before it came out. Mm. You know, it's kind of sad that it's one thing if you got to put something into production to keep the rights, but it's another to just basically fool people into bleeding over this production when you know that it's just going to sit in a vault.
Well, the silliest thing about that case is, and I this has to be known, the reason why the 90s Fantastic Four movie was made is because something had to be in production in order to keep the rights. That's the story for every Fantastic Four movie that has been made. And that's why they're always so rushed. The difference is that it just needs to be in production. They could have stayed in pre-production for decades and not shot a single frame and would have been fine. So the fact that they went ahead and just made it, that documentary is brilliant. And if you can find the filmmaker online, you can buy a Blu-ray copy from him directly. And he does have a nice quality version of the film as well, that he'll include as like a bonus disc. So it's well worth seeking out. But yeah, they even interview Lloyd Kaufman of Troma about, because he was approached to do it too. And he was of the mindset of, that's not cool. Making a movie and not releasing it, I'm not going to make something that's not going to be released. Whereas Corman was like, you know, money, why not?
Yeah. I won't say it soured me on Roger Corman, but it kind of took him down a peg or two in my mind, because I've always thought that he was like a for the people kind of a filmmaker. And this kind of bummed me out on him. The fact that he was on the studio side rather than his people's side.
Yeah. But I genuinely think that movie was pretty, it was a lot of fun. And I do think it is the best film version of Ben Grimm that we have. And the thing, like, they really nailed his tragic story. And the costume wasn't bad for what it was. Like,
the costume's kind of rad. The costume, because it, to make his facial features, they had like animatronics. I mean, the costume's pretty good.
Yeah.
I can't believe they put so much effort into something that they knew was not going to see the light of day.
Well, a lot of crew
it is funny too how then they integrated that plot line into Arrested Development. David Cross's character, Tobias, hooks up with not the real one, but like an actress who played Sue Storm in that version of the Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie. And yeah, in this alternate universe, also the Fantastic Four movie came out and was on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah, it was played by who's that comedian?
Was it Maria Bamford?
Yes, Maria Bamford, and she was fantastic because she's just like going through like all these type of addictions, and David and Tobias is just thinking, oh, this is part of your acting process. Gotcha. Okay, so yeah, we're living on the street or something now. And it just like kept going. Yeah, that was one of the few highlights of season 4.
He also meets her at what he thinks is a Method 1 clinic or acting course, but it's actually a methadone clinic.
Season 4 was pretty solid of Arrested Development, especially once they like re-edited it into the format of like previous seasons. It had some really gold moments, and Maria Bamford as the actress who played Sue Storm in the 90s Fantastic Four was a great plot. Plus, you also had the amazing joke, Cinco de Cuatro. I is still my favorite.
So yeah, that was a good one. Let's see. Also on my end, we had a screening at the Era recently for the original 1966 Sergio Corbucci's Django with none other than Franco Nero in person.
Ah, so jealous.
Yeah, no, it was an amazing show. And Django isn't really outright horror, but I feel like Corbucci had a lot of horror influences, because like it's just very haunting with how, you know, a lot of times he's walking alone in like the Badlands, and it's just graveyards everywhere.
And he's dragging a coffin behind him throughout most of the movie.
Dragging a coffin behind him.
Which that is just an eerie image. Like, I mean, talk about, I mean, I know I talk about Roadhouse a lot with like greatest intimidation lines and whatever, but you're not going to fuck with a dude who's walking across a desert dragging a coffin behind him, because
and the people who do, he kills.
Yeah. You're going to be like, wait, is that for me? Or is there someone else already in there? Turns out it's a giant ass gun, which is even worse.
It's a chain gun. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, yeah, Django's dope.
Yeah, and it was very interesting to hear Franco Nero talk about the movie and about working with Corbucci, specifically on the tenets that Django is a very left-leaning film and kind of matching Corbucci's politics. You know, he fights the Ku Klux Klan, or like a stand-in for the Ku Klux Klan, like former Confederates. And I was talking about how like Sergio Leone would visit the set, and how Lucio Fulci... he met Lucio Fulci, and oh man, he had a lot of stories about Fulci, just in that Fulci would just bullshit all the time. Like he'd meet up with Franco Nero and says like, oh, sorry, Franco, I was just having lunch with John F. Kennedy Jr. Or with JFK.
What to be a fly on that wall of that set and see all these legendary people coming by just to visit.
I mean, it would have been, it sounds like it was a hell of an experience. And he even talked about working on Django Unchained and just kind of the process that led to that. Because like for a long time, he thought Tarantino wasn't going to include him. And he even tried pitching Tarantino an idea that his Django would be Jamie Foxx's Django's real father.
Yeah, I mean, it's not disproven in the movie, you know. I'm just still waiting for Django Strikes Again to get a proper like home video release, because as far as I know, it's only been released on VHS, and it's the only official sequel to Django. Like Django movies are its own subgenre of movies ripping using that title, including two that involve Tarantino between Sukiyaki, Western Django, and Django Unchained. But my VHS of Django Strikes Again is kept in pristine condition.
Yeah. And also, interestingly enough, on the Arrow Blu-ray, there's it came with the bonus movie Texas Adios, which was also kind of considered a pseudo Django sequel, pretty much just because it had Franco Nero in a similar role. So, yeah, now just Italian movie franchise can get weird like that.
But that theme song.
Oh, yeah, it's a banger.
Absolute banger.
Let's move on to our topic, which it's awards season, and you've seen all the Critics Awards and the Globes and the Critics Choice, and the Oscars are coming up. And as an aside here, I don't know if we have any Oscar voters here, but please, please, if you're an Oscar voter, watch Robot Dreams, because it's the best animated movie of the year. I know that people are going to fight me on that for Boy and the Heron and Spider-Man Across the Universe, across the Spider-Verse, but Robot Dreams.
Actually, if you're a voter, watch all the fucking movies that are nominated. Yeah, Jesus Christ.
We'll get into that with the real topic. But the only real exciting thing about the Oscars this year for horror is now we have Academy Award nominee Godzilla Minus One.
Oh yeah.
And Poor Things.
Oh yeah, Poor Things. Yep. Yeah. Poor Things actually got its share as well. Yeah. But we're not gonna talk about the Oscars, but watch Robot Dreams. we're gonna talk about the Razzies, which I don't think any of us are really a big fan of the Razzies. And what I was saying, well, you know, watch all the movies. In researching for this episode, I realized that Razzie voters, it's not a requirement for them to watch every nominee. Anyway, the Razzies, if you're not familiar with them, which you probably are, but if you're not, they are kind of a worst of, which I've made my feelings on worst of lists known as well. It's just I just don't got time for it. But anyway, the Razzies, they do worst picture, worst director, worst, you know, and it started in 1980. And let me, we were laughing about the worst picture nominees for 1980. Let's look at them.
You might have been laughing. I wasn't laughing. I got fired the fuck up.
Laughing meaning how ridiculous it is. But okay, the winner was Can't Stop the Music. Can't Stop the Music, I can see that. That is, if you're not familiar with Can't Stop the Music, it's basically what Spice World was, but for the Village People.
I was about to say, that's a Village People movie, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's But the other nominees, Cruising. What? The Formula, Friday the 13th. What?
Yeah.
The Jazz Singer.
Directed by Richard Fletcher, who did 10 Rillington Place.
The Jazz Singer?
Yeah, he did the 80s Jazz Singer.
The Nude Bomb. Raise the Titanic. Saturn 3? Really? Was Saturn 3 thought of as bad when it came out?
I don't know. I thought it was fun.
Windows and Xanadu. Okay. Some of these I can see, but Friday the 13th and Cruisin'.
Also, a part of inspiration for talking about the Razzies now is because the Criterion is kind of taking the Razzies back in that they added an entire section to the Criterion channel and the Razzies goes to where they've added several Razzies nominated and award winning movies to the channel so that people can watch them and potentially reevaluate them.
Some of them are not bad.
Yeah, no, they got Cruising, The Blair Witch Project, Showgirls, Heaven's Gate, and stuff like Freddy Got Fingered, the Wicker Man remake, and Geely.
Looking at some of these other, like, not only nominees, winners, 1981, Mommy Dearest won. Is Mommy Dearest considered a bad movie? I think it's pretty good.
It did pretty well, from what I understand.
The one that I really don't get, 1985, Rambo, First Blood Part 2, won the Razzie for Worst Picture. Is Rambo considered bad? Rambo's a good movie.
And that's the thing, too, is that, like, you got to remember with this show, the voters are not required to watch any of these movies. And so a lot of this is just reactionary to, it's like the earliest form of internet trolling before the internet.
I was going to say, nowadays, I think people pile on to what is considered bad or what's considered a joke in the internet. But back in 1980, I guess, I know that Siskel and Ebert totally panned Friday the 13th. They hated it. So it might be, and Cruisin', I guess they could have been going on the subject matter.
Ooh, and I definitely will get into that in a little bit.
Yeah, I just don't get Howard the Duck won Worst Picture in 86.
With Under the Cherry Moon.
It was a split. Yeah, it tied. Some of these, like Showgirls won, which Showgirls has only been seen as a good movie in retrospect. Once people started understanding Paul Verhoeven's career and how everything he does is kind of a parody. And interestingly enough, Paul Verhoeven for Showgirls was the first winner to show up in person to collect his Razzie.
Because of course he would. Of course. That's a total Paul Verhoeven move. And the thing about Showgirls is it's not a badly made movie.
No.
It's purely the script, honestly. Like, and rewatching Vinegar Syndrome's gorgeous 4K, the visuals, the dancing, that, like, Verhoeven went all out on, like, making like a classic Hollywood, like, musical number movie that just happens to feature a lot of sex. And it really is like a gorgeous looking film. But yes, the script is a little rough, to put nicely. But yeah, dude, it's again, a lot of this is reactionary to, like, just reading headlines because no one's required to watch any of this. And there are times where it does seem a bit skewed into some isms. I mean, Cruising being nominated. Cruising is a fantastic film. And as Jay said earlier, why would it end up on this list other than perhaps its subject matter, you know, of exploring, you know, leather bars and stuff. Tyler Perry's films get nominated all the time. Oftentimes it does seem to dogpile on women often as well as minorities. And so there's times where it's just like, I wish there was more effort. It feels lazy. A lot of the times these nominations and stuff, like it's too much of an obvious choice or too lazy of a choice. And it's like, what are your goals here? Are your goals just to be an asshole? Because if so, cool, just be an asshole. But is your goal to actually like call out the industry for some of this stuff? Because there are times when they do call out stuff that needs to be called out. Like they do special categories, right? Like they'll do stuff like worst excuse for family entertainment, you know, which is, you know, stuff that needs to be called out of just like, dude, you're not putting actual effort into something that families would watch.
In 2010, they did worst eye gouging misuse of 3D. And anyone who remembers the 3D trend of 2010, that's a category that was needed. Absolutely needed.
Yeah. Charge an extra $10 to just get your eyes assaulted by post 3D. That's just, yeah, haphazardly done.
Sometimes it's kind of like poking fun at the movie. Like there was a special category in 97, worst reckless disregard for human life and public property. Con Air won it, but the other nominees are The Lost World, Jurassic Park, Turbulence, Volcano, and Batman and Robin. It's like all of those movies, it's reckless disregard for human life and public property. And I love that Con Air won because, okay, they landed a plane on the Las Vegas Strip.
A massive plane, yeah. I fucking love Con Air.
I love Con Air. I don't know why Nicolas Cage could have retired after 97 and the double shot of Con Air and Face Off, and his legacy in cinematic history would have been cemented.
But thank God he didn't, because then we wouldn't have adaptation. I'm glad he didn't, though,
because we've gotten some good stuff since.
Yeah. But my question to you guys is, if this was better organized and had more of like a goal of like actually critiquing, being a critic, a chance to critique and not just like troll or come off lazy, do you guys think that this is a valid thing? Because I know we often talk about how worst of lists are tacky and lame and just like shitty, but like we all know that making a film, it takes multiple miracles. It's not just one miracle. It takes hundreds, and there's so many hours of blood, sweat, and tears put into the making of even the worst films ever. So is there a place for something like this, or is this just punching down?
Well, it is interesting because I do feel like the Razzies in some ways were ahead of their time in that they kind of exemplify what we see a lot in social media and the internet in terms of accentuating the negative in commentary and reviews. But as you also pointed out, it does sometimes do a good job at poking fun at trends, especially on the more corporate or studio side of things, and just kind of just stuff that may be considered an annoyance to audiences. But also on the other hand, it does kind of punch down sometimes. Like they only just recently removed child actors from their worst actors category, so there is some mean-spiritedness to it. So I don't know. I mean, like, I think maybe it would have to be restructured, or they'd have to kind of reinterpret how they do the Razzies. But you know, that maybe there is something to it.
It's definitely punching down, as I think worst of lists are. And the thing is, and I guess the same could be said about the best of lists or awards. Film is subjective, and you know, opinions, like looking at, I think I was looking at the year that Cats was released. It won the Razzie for worst film. Cats is awesome. I've told you guys that. but a lot of people disagree with me on that.
Agree to disagree.
It's not only film criticism, I'll just say film opinions, is so subjective that, you know, if you say these are the worst movies, you know, I do like the special categories. And that's where I think that the Razzies should concentrate, because they do, you know, now one that is kind of funny, unless you realize why it went on, they had worst Bruce Willis performance in a 2021 movie. Bruce Willis made like 8 movies in 2021. Now, back when he was doing this, no one realized that he knew his diagnosis and he was banking money for when he couldn't work anymore. So in retrospect, it's a little sad. And the Razzies, to their credit, I think that they do go back in retrospect. Like, they rescinded Shelley Duvall's nomination for The Shining decades after, because they realized that that performance was a product of Stanley Kubrick's abuse. And honestly, I think that Shelley Duvall's performance in The Shining is really good if you know the character. You know, she's supposed to be kind of skittish and, you know, and nervous like that. So anyway, at first glance, the worst Bruce Willis performance looks like it's kind of just poking fun at his body of work that year. But when you realize why he did so many movies, it's a little sad. But as far as just going worst actor, worst actress, worst director, that I don't think is as necessary as that. They're not calling out the industry so much as they're just emphasizing their own opinions on what is bad. It's a worst of list, basically, which I don't really like worst of list. And because, like you said, any movie that gets made should be celebrated, I think. Yeah. And I'm a pretty soft critic. I can generally find something about any movie that I like, which except Madame Web, which Madame Web, I can guarantee will be a Razzie nominee next year.
One of the things that I do respect about them is they do tend to keep the nominees being these more big budget studio films. They don't go after indies too often.
Except the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, they nominate. Jesus. Yeah. No. If we want to bring it back to horror, the fact that both Blair Witches were nominated and were nominated pretty across the board. Because if I do recall, like the first one, they gave the lead actress worst actress too. It's. So there's some aspects where I'm like, yes, call out the industry for, stuff like 1996, worst written movie grossing over $100 million, you know, which like,
that's kind of a rad category.
It is. But then you look at the nominees and it's Twister. It's Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's Independence Day. It's Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
A Time to Kill. Those are all great movies. Like, it's just like, wait, what? And then that's where like that disconnect kind of is. It's like, is this actually like, and where is that like criteria for any of these things? I mean, I kind of understand with like Oscars and stuff that there might be a bit of a criteria, but is there even there? Because like we said, like Razzies, they're not required to watch the movies. Oscars, they are, but they don't enforce it, you know?
Yeah. Here's a great special category. 1998, worst movie trends of the year. And the winner was 58-year-old leading men wooing 28-year-old leading ladies. But here, the other nominees were trailers that give away the film's entire plot, longer movies, shorter plots, THX deafening audio, mega zillion dollar cross promotional overkill, Armageddon, Godzilla, etc.
Yeah, but I gotta say, the promotional overkill of Godzilla 98 is fucking dope as someone who owns quite a few pieces of it.
Well, that's why it didn't win. 58-year-old leading men wooing 28-year-old leading ladies was the winner. But longer movies, shorter plots. Oh, I'm still on that plane. Come on, let's get rid of that. I hate that. I was hoping Gravity a few years ago would bring back the 90-minute Oscar winner. I mean, like I said, Killers of the Flower Moon, I love the first 2.5 hours. The last hour drag. I mean, that was a long one.
I just want to know, because they also have other awards like the Razzie Redeemer Award of people who have made really good comebacks, which was awarded to like Ben Affleck, Sylvester Stallone, Melissa McCarthy, Eddie Murphy, and so on. And I think that's cool, recognizing like, okay, so you made a few stinkers, but you came back. Awesome. But I just want to know, because they have worst career achievement. And they gave one to Linda Blair in 83. Like, what did Linda Blair do up to 83 that earned her that, you know?
Exorcist sequels and movies like Grotesque, you know, like she was stuck in horror movies.
Hell Night. Hell Night around then.
Yeah, she was stuck in low budget horror movies, which, you know, she was considered a scream queen back then.
But when did Savage Streets come out? Because that should not be used against her. Because
that was 84.
So she didn't get a Redeemer Award for doing Savage Streets after? She should have.
Yeah. Although I also like when like an actor or filmmaker kind of takes back the Razzie, like you were saying with Paul Verhoeven, you know, accept being the first director to accept his. And also one of my favorite stories around the Razzies was how Halle Berry won Worst Actress for Catwoman. And so she showed up to collect the Razzie while holding her Oscar.
Yeah. The Oscar, was it Monsters Ball that she won her Oscar
for? I think it was for
yeah.
Monsters Ball.
Yeah, and she showed up with her Oscar to the client. That's leaning into it. Those are people who are kind of not really into the joke, because I don't really think it's a joke, but those are people who are having fun with it. And that's, I think, the spirit that it was originally, back in 1980 when it was originally conceived, I think it was more of like a, you know, just like a joke. Let's have fun with this. And I think it got out of hand to where nowadays it's just really mean spirited, you know, to the point where they nominate little kids who, you know,
well,
a little kid's not going to take it as an honor, like Halle Berry, you know, a little kid's not going to take it, or like Paul Verhoeven, they're not going to take it in stride and think, oh yeah, you know, let's lean into this. They're going to be hurt.
Well, remember, they had been nominating kids for decades, because Macaulay Culkin was nominated for like three of his movies that came out in 95, you know? So there was definitely like a lot of that going on. And there are little moments. I know my girl Sandy Bullock showed up for What About Steve? And it was because the Razzies is done the night before the Oscars. So she won a Razzie for Worst Actress of the Year, and then the next day won for Best Actress for The Blind Side. But she showed up to Razzies with DVD copies of What About Steve and started handing them out to everybody. So like, I like, you know, stuff like that where people are taking it back. But I mean, it's just, again, where's the disconnect? I mean, listen, I'm a huge Neil Diamond fan, and The Jazz Singer, I understand it has its problems and all that stuff, but like, that soundtrack is dope. But it's still weird that like Neil Diamond to be nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Performance, but then also won for Worst Actor for the same exact performance. You know, it's, again, where is the connection? You know what I mean?
Could it be that the Razzies saw it as problematic in its day? And the Globes didn't?
No, they weren't thinking of that scene, which is just, again, you're remaking The Jazz Singer in the 80s, and you're like, man, I know the original film was all about blackface. We have to have a scene where we put Neil Diamond in blackface, right?
No, you don't. No, you don't.
But it is.
Why?
But I will say this, because of that scene, Ernie Hudson had one of his first speaking roles. So, I mean, that doesn't redeem it, but it's still really funny that Ernie Hudson is the heckler that calls out Neil Diamond for being in blackface in the movie. I always like pointing that
rightfully
out.
Rightfully so.
Yeah. Oh, God. I wanted to ask him that question so many times when working with him, but I was like, no. Let's keep him professional. But
from what you said, it sounds like he's a pretty cool guy. So he probably would have given you a straight answer.
I know, but it's not always the best look to talk to people about their careers when you're at work. Someday though, we'll be buds, and I'll ask Ernie Hudson all the questions about Penitentiary 2 and The Jazz Singer that my heart desires.
While sitting in a hot tub with a beer with him.
Oh man, one can dream, right? One can dream.
You can dream.
But at the end of the day, the Razzies are punching down, and we're not fans of that. We're not fans of worst of list. But I do think that there is, especially in this age where of movie making, where the mid-budget film is almost non-existent and everything is either tentpole or made for next to nothing. I do think that there should be more calling out of the industry. And I just don't know if this type of format is the way to go about it. I think what we saw with Madam Web and Dakota Johnson and just using that platform to call it out is pretty brilliant, and I applaud her for it. But yeah, it's 2024. Do we really need to be making worst of lists?
I haven't made them. Because also some of my colleagues in the Film Critics Society, one of whom is a Razzie voter, by the way, but some of them on their worst of lists, I was seeing movies that are on my best of list. Bo is Afraid made a couple of their worst of lists, and it was on my best of list. So it's all subjective. Let's take a look at the 2023 worst picture nominees and see how many of them we actually liked. First, The Exorcist Believer. I liked the first half. Kind of fell apart.
Yeah, I never got around to that one.
Expendables 4, I didn't see, so I don't know. Meg 2, The Trench.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't we all love Meg 2, The Trench?
Yeah, no, I had a great time with that one.
Shazam, Fury of the Gods. For a Shazam movie, it is what it is. It did have, you know, unicorns and, you know, minotaurs and stuff. It was cool. Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey. For what it was, a Winnie the Pooh slasher, I thought it was okay. But anyway.
Look over this list. I mean, it's all kind of lazy, isn't it? I mean, like, I can understand some of these getting, called out, you know, but like, it just, first of all, I don't know what the Razzies have against Stallone and pretty much everything he does, but like, it's pretty, I know he got a Redeemer Award, but it seems like if you look through the history of it, I mean, that year that Rambo 2 was nominated, so was Rocky 4, which I again will fight anyone in the back parking lot over Rocky 4. but like, even just looking over, you know, all this stuff, like Indiana Jones Dial of Destiny is nominated for worst remake, ripoff, or sequel, you know, and it's like that it was an Indiana Jones movie. That's what it was. Anyone who critiques it for being too like, oh, there's time travel, oh, there's things, it's like, bro, do you not remember the ghost bits in Raiders of the Lost Ark? Like,
yeah,
face melting. There was always that weird shit in there. But yeah, it's just, and it just feels lazy. I mean, look at the worst screen combo. They just said any two people in Expendable Fours, you know, Expendables, or any two money grubbing investors who donated to the $400 million, $400 million for remake rights to The Exorcist Believer.
That was kind of funny, though.
Again, broken clocks are right twice a day. So, like,
any two money grubbing investors who donated to The Exorcist Believer, that's good. That's good times. But yeah, it worst remake, ripoff, or sequel is another one of those categories I think might be justified, because I don't think Indiana Jones belongs on it, but I understand the spirit of the award is, you know, do something original, Hollywood. So,
But also, why is Selma Hayek nominated for Magic Mike's Last Dance? Because, like, she was definitely not the worst part of that movie long shot.
They're just trying to find ways to nominate Magic Mike's Last Dance,
which there is very valid critiques on for that. Trust me, as the resident Magic Mike fan of the group. That movie peaked with that first dance between Selma Hayek and Channing Tatum, and it just could not recover from how fucking hot that dance was. You couldn't. It was too much sexiness.
All right. Well, let's wrap this one up. So, in conclusion, Razzies, kind of punching down. What do you guys think of the Razzies? Are they necessary? Or are they just mean-spirited? I'm kind of on the fence with that, because I think parts of them are not necessarily necessary, but they do call out Hollywood in some places. But mostly, I think they are just mean-spirited.
And either way, I'll be watching the Razzie movies on the Criterion Channel.
Yeah, yeah.
Freddy Got Fingered is a Criterion movie. We can say that.
I was about to say that, like, I do love this kind of taking back that the Criterion Channel is doing, especially when it comes to Freddy Got Fingered, because I do have a gray market Blu-ray of Freddy Got Fingered, and the artwork is made to look like a Criterion collection.
Have you seen someone made a Criterion cover for the fake movie inside of Boogie Nights, Angels Live in My Town?
That's awesome.
I really do love the kind of cottage industry of fake Criterion covers, because, like, I've also seen one for Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox Story, and just any movie can be improved by giving it a Criterion style cover,
which I gotta say, I finally convinced someone to rewatch Pop Star with me, because I've been wanting to watch Pop Star again.
Yeah,
Tim Meadows is the goat of music parody actors, and I feel like he needs to be included in more projects. Like, I need more Tim Meadows in my life, because his performance in Walk Hard and Pop Star are just top tier.
Cool. Well, let's get out of here. Watch Robot Dreams. Trust me, you won't regret it. And let us know what you think of the Razzies, and if you agree with us, or if maybe you love them. Maybe you think they're hilarious, but I don't know. Our music is by Restless Spirit, so go give them a listen. And our artwork is by Chris Fisher, so go give him a like. You can find us on any of the socials under Ion Horror or at ihorror.com, which is the website that we all call home. Yeah, go to iHorror, and speaking of awards, vote on the iHorror Awards. They're all up there.
Which is awesome because they are highlighting horror short films, which is always great to uplift, you know, independent filmmakers. So watch all the films that are nominated for iHorror Awards, especially the short films, and let's, you know, get these new voices out there.
Speaking of short films, just real quick, since we're signing off, have you guys watched Gridlock? Ian Hunt's the short that he talked about last week. Oh, it's really good. It's about 20 minutes. It's on YouTube. It's good. Check it out.
Yeah, check it out. Gridlock.
Ian Hunt
Duffley.
Yep. Ian Hunt Duffley. And we will see you guys in a couple of weeks. I'm giving you guys homework. Watch Gridlock on YouTube. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. So for me, James J. Edwards.
I'm Jacob Davison.
And I'm Jonathan Correa.
Keep your eye on horror.